I'm Douglas Frank, and I'm here with David Murkowski to have a little conversation. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Douglas. Glad to be here.
And thank you for joining me in this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So during this period of COVID, how are you and Rachel doing?
Yeah, so Rachel's my wife. So we're doing okay, for sure. We're pretty fortunate in our situation. We're staying at home, playing it pretty safe, pretty conservative. My wife and I are both in that older cohort. We both have, or she has some complicating conditions. So a lot of staying at home, picking up our groceries at the store, a little bit more socializing now since it seems to be safe being outside, but definitely doing okay. But every day definitely seems kind of the same. And sometimes I lose track of those days. Like, wow, today is Saturday or Friday or Sunday. So some of that, but that's kind of good and bad. Yeah, so definitely doing okay.
My wife and I, we watched Groundhog Day a couple weeks ago because it just feels like Groundhog Day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did you come to the Dharma?
Yeah, how I came to the Dharma. So kind of somewhat of a long story. I'll try to keep it short or shorter. But it goes back probably to the 70s with Trungpa Rinpoche. Yeah, but I was thinking about that. Before that in the 60s, you know, I was going to college. It was the 1960s, summer of love in San Francisco. And I was thinking about that question of what brought me to the Dharma, because some people can talk about some kind of suffering that's really a problem for them and that they feel like the Dharma might relieve that. I really don't think that was me. I think it was more a spiritual awakening kind of thing. So back in the 60s, you know, like a lot of us or some of us back then, you know, psychedelics kind of opened up that window, you know, kind of opened up the mind to something more profound than what was going on in my everyday life, you know. Mm-hmm. And that encouraged me to kind of be a seeker in some ways, I guess you could say. Something about some larger reality, something bigger than myself in that way. So I think I did a little bit of Zen meditation with a Zen group, kind of dabbled around in some ways. But in 1973, 74, I was going to grad school at CU, living on a little small farmhouse out on the edge of town by Palo Park. And these two hippie women and one of their boyfriends showed up. It was the first summer institute for Naropa Institute. Mm-hmm. And they came mostly to see Ram Dass, who was
right.
a pretty important figure back then, including for me, because I read his book, Be Here Now, which was pretty good. And then the other draw was Trungpa Rinpoche. So I attended a few of those talks. I attended some of the Ram Dass talks, some of the Trungpa Rinpoche talks, never really made a strong connection. Ended up, one of the women became my girlfriend in terms of a serious relationship. And she ended up moving from Ram Dass to Trungpa Rinpoche. So I started getting introduced to Vajra Datu Sangha members, maybe went to a few more talks, but never really made a connection. In fact, some of the Sangha members kind of were a turnoff. You know, there was quite a bit of arrogance back there, at least in my mind, hanging out with these guys, you know. So it wasn't particularly enjoyable. And changed girlfriends and got some encouragement, you know, with this. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you, the big breakthrough for me was in probably 76, maybe, when Trungpa Rinpoche introduced Shambhala training. And with some strong encouragement from my wife at that time, Rachel, I ended up going to the first level of Shambhala, having a really, really good weekend.
Do you remember who the teacher was for that first weekend?
You know, I don't. I can picture the person, you know. But he was really kind. He was gentle. And, you know, it was a funny Shambhala level training. It was Shambhala level one. But Allen Ginsberg was in the training along with his partner, Peter Orlovsky.
Okay.
Sultan Alioni was one of the meditation practice and kind of instructors, you know.
Okay.
It was the early days of Shambhala training. So a lot of Vajra students were going through it at
okay.
that time. So I was one. Kind of an unusual one, just out of the public coming to this. But it was a very profound training. So I stayed with it, level 2, 3, 4. And at that time, level 5, which was kind of the capstone, Trungpa Rinpoche was actually teaching it. And he gave us instructions on stroke practice. And I'll tell you, that weekend was very profound too. So I made a strong connection with the Shambhala teachings. And
describe stroke practice for people who don't know what this is.
Yeah, so stroke practice, I think, is a lot of like a lot of Dharma practices. It's really a practice of letting go of this entity we call me, ourself. Because in that practice, you're connecting with a more profound reality, for sure, as part of the stroke. And it's very symbolic in terms of how you do that stroke. But at the very end of the stroke practice, you do you cut and you let go. And that letting go is letting go of this sense of me. At least was my experience.
Okay. And it's with a brush and ink, right?
With a brush and ink, yeah. A piece of blank white paper, a very large brush, very black ink. And it's kind of a Japanese practice of, you know, that Trungpa Rinpoche brought to us through these Shambhala trainings. And again, very symbolic in how you do it. You kind of do it with some real pressure, some real experience. And then there's a definitely letting go process at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a practice I did. It was really one of my early Dharma practices, the mental energy. And I think gave me some glimpses of that kind of larger reality.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
So then, I did that for a pretty long time, and it wasn't until 1981 that I decided I'll become a Buddhist.
So you were doing Shambhala in the stroke practice. Were you doing that with other people, or was that something you were just doing?
Yeah, definitely both. You know, and I did find with the group practice, you know, it was a good thing to do in a group practice. Yeah, for sure. But it was mostly a practice I was doing on my own.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And then what was the next?
Well, the next big step was to actually decide it was okay to be a Buddhist. I was pretty far along on my path. Trungpa Rinpoche was this really good teacher out of the Shambhala training. Mm-hmm. So in 1981, I took refuge with Trungpa Rinpoche. And that was wonderful. That was up at Shambhala Mountain at that time, Rocky Mountain Dharma Center. We went down to his little house where he was staying. He was sitting there. And I came in. I had my Shambhala pin on it. I think it was my first level pin. It wasn't even my graduate level pin. And he looked at me, and the name he gave me was really wonderful. It was Maitri Great East. So I really liked that name a lot, because I was coming out of the Shambhala world, embracing the Buddhist world at that time. And that was my refuge name. So at that point in 1981, I started becoming a Buddhist, went through a lot of the study programs the Vajradhatu and Trungpa Rinpoche created, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana. Ended up going to assembly, Shambhala assembly first. Normally people would go to the Buddhist seminary and then from there go to assembly, which are these advanced kinds of trainings and things. But I ended up going to assembly first, but right after that went to the first Vajradhatu Seminary at Rocky Mountain Dharma Center.
Okay.
Living in tents, practicing in a tent, being outdoors in nature. Really suited me well. That was wonderful.
So at what point did you meet Phunlap Rinpoche?
Yeah, that wasn't until 2004.
Okay.
So I had this huge gap in my Buddhist training. In 1987, when Trungpa Rinpoche passed on, I had just kind of stepped away from that whole Shambhala Vajradhatu community. And it wasn't until 2004 that I found another teacher. There were a lot of Tibetan teachers coming to Boulder doing weekend teachings. My wife would go, she'd say, you should go check this guy out. And I would go and it would be okay, but nothing real profound. And then 2004, she said, oh, go check this guy out. He's pretty cool. So I went there for the weekend teaching of Rinpoche, Phunlap Rinpoche. And I go, wow, this is my teacher, I think.
Okay. Do you remember what the weekend was?
You know, I don't. But he was this emanation of kindness and profundity and genuineness and friendliness, you know.
Okay.
And I was really missing that.
Yeah.
And I was always shy and I could never ask a question of any of these other teachers I had. But with him, I actually felt I could go up to the microphone and ask a question, and I did, you know. That was something. That year after he left Boulder and went back to wherever he was, I guess Seattle, gave me a chance to kind of check out the local Sangha here, to do a study program with Yurka, and Lalanda Bodhi study program. And when Rinpoche came back, I asked for an interview and asked to become a student. And that was in 2004, so, or something like that, 2005, yeah.
So during your time with Trungpa Rinpoche, was there a teaching that became like a North Star for you coming out of studying with him?
You know, I'm going to say there were two teachings, but I wouldn't say either one of them were North Stars at that time. I mean, Shambhala training was probably, with stroke practice was my, was my teaching and my North Star. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there were two teachings there that everybody had exposure to, the Heart Sutra and the supplication to the Tapo Kagyu. And those were very mysterious teachings, very pithy teachings, you know, but very profound. I've had kind of glimpses when we were chanting those things, you know, never really studied them. But it really wasn't until 2004 within the Nalanda Bodhi study program with with Panlong Purpose, those teachings really came out to me and became my, you know, a couple of primary teachings on my path.
Okay, so
with more and more understanding, as well as I can say I have some understanding of both of those teachings.
So the supplication to the Tagpo Kagyu and the Heart Sutra.
Yeah, let me say in the Heart Sutra, you know, really the key part of that teaching is where Shariputra asks Avalokitesara, how should one practice the profound Prajnaparamita? And Avalokitesara says, one should practice the profound Prajnaparamita by seeing the five skandhas being empty of nature, right? Mm-hmm. So in that one little sentence, this is huge, huge teaching on letting go of ourself, on selflessness. Mm-hmm. So it's really kind of a Hinayana teaching, you know, but hugely profound if we practice it. I think people have said, you know, if you can really realize selflessness, you've probably realized 90% of the Dharma.
So did the Heart Sutra and stroke practice sort of come together in some kind of a way?
Yeah, well, I think so, because I think, again, it's that letting go of the self. And I think it's a very practical teaching too, you know. I mean, it's profound in many ways, but it's very practical. For me, the practical part of that is practicing on letting go of being self-centered, letting go of any sense of self-importance, kind of practicing modesty, not having this really solid sense of self, you know, going more lightly in the world in that way. So, and every day, you know, we can practice that, I think. And it's been very helpful, very useful, you know, to kind of have some more understanding of the five skandhas.
And so how does the supplication to the Tagpo Kagyu fit in with this?
So again, an amazingly pithy teaching with really profound pointing out instructions, for sure, I think, in that way. And there's one verse, you know, that I think I want to share here, because it's a very profound verse and really gets to this. That is, I'm going to read this. Awareness is the body of meditation as is taught. Whatever arises is fresh. The essence of realization to this meditator who rests simply without altering it. Grant your blessing so that my meditation is free from conception. So it's a beautiful teaching saying that, you know, everything that we experience is fresh. Everything is right here in this present moment, fresh. We don't need to add anything to it. We can just be with it, rest simply without altering it. And it's a teaching on non-conceptual wisdom too. So what we have here with these two teachings, you know, one is a teaching, you know, what people talk about in terms of wisdom is non-dual, non-conceptual wisdom. So that teaching on non-self is the non-dual part of that. This teaching on from the Tapo Kagyu supplication is on non-conceptuality. And again, something that can be practiced every day in terms of not labeling things, not naming things, not getting caught up in complexity of concepts.
This is beautiful. It's beautiful hearing you talk about this.
So I have to say, maybe there's one more little teaching that I think actually works well too. And it's a short teaching. It's one of Lama Tempa's favorite teachings, which is, like a dream, like an illusion, like a city of Gandharvas. That's how birth and that's how living, that's how dying is taught to be. Beautiful teaching about, just brings a lot of this stuff together, you know, that we're experiencing the world, you know, as not being solid, not being real, being impermanent, changing, and being interdependent, all of those things. It's a wonderful practice. You can practice this walking around. Go to a shopping mall sometime and sing that song. Sing it to yourself with all these people walking around. It's wonderful.
I love, it is so sweet. And the melody is, it's very catchy.
Catchy and relaxing at the same time. Yeah.
It is. It's very, very sweet.
Another teaching, letting go. Yeah.
And letting go. Yeah. So during this period of COVID, how are you relating the Dharma to your time with this?
Yeah. So I think, again, I'm very fortunate that here in Boulder, you know, we don't have a strict, we didn't really have a strict lockdown policy. We could get out and walk around our neighborhoods, keep our distance, and eventually wear masks, you know, if you can't keep your distance. And I live in a beautiful neighborhood right near the foothills. So for me, going on walks is really important. Being out in the natural world, being in nature, you know, and taking some of these practices with me, you know. So I wouldn't say I'm really good at it, because like probably most people, you know, I go for walks. I think about what happened to me this morning when I was having breakfast, what I got to do later. Fortunately, there's not much to worry about what I have to do later, you know, so not too preoccupied with the future that way, like I might when I was working. So just being out in nature, you know, taking these walks every once in a while, trying to have a glimpse, you know, of some kind of direct sense perception, just being in the present moment. Looking at the clouds and having a more open, spacious experience. So things like that, for sure. That's been very, very helpful for me.
So being out in the world, out in nature, really, it sounds like it really helps you connect with some of these basic practices that you have integrated into your daily life, is what this sounds like to me.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think there's definitely the intention, but it does take some effort too. So in other words, is it pretty easy to get lost in thoughts or doing something else? And so you have to, I still have to certainly bring some effort, you know, into kind of experiencing, you know, this present moment, or to be reminded, you know, that everything is connected, or that everything is permanent, everything is changing. I mean, it's kind of easy when we're out in nature, you know, to have that, but it does take some effort to kind of, you know, stop the conceptual thinking process and be a little less non-conceptual.
So what is your, so it's kind of like a mindfulness thing to remember to let go of all of the conceptualizing. So what is your remembering to come back to?
Yeah, well, I think it's just simply being in that present moment and being quite open and having some sense of spaciousness. Remember, you know, Lama Tempe had this beautiful teaching about no center, no periphery. And I remember having that experience looking at the sky one time on a walk, you know. So definitely that kind of sense of spaciousness. You know, a little bit of sense in myself. I wouldn't say that's really, that's hard, you know, still very hard.
What was that? I didn't catch what.
Oh, that sense of that there, the non-duality part of it, the non-self part. You know, because there's still a sense of me walking out there. It's really me. It's David. You know, it's me with all my habitual patterns over 70 years, you know. That part is a lot harder.
If it was easy, everybody would be doing it.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I find these other things to be a little bit easier in terms of experiences.
Yeah.
But they're all kind of, you know, connected in some ways, for sure.
So being out in nature is a major way that you are working with this COVID time. Mm-hmm. Is there any other, so this sounds like a pretty passionate activity mm-hmm. to just get out and move around and
yeah, I would say, you know, I've definitely had this passion for being out in the natural world and nature for a long, long time. Yeah. Back in the 60s and 70s, you know, backpacking. In the 80s, I had this really stressful job, and we went on this camping trip, and went up to a very high peak, well above tree line, beautiful. And I just reconnected there with the high mountains above tree line, you know, and mm-hmm. did that for a long, long time. Now, as I got older, it's a little harder to go out on these long hikes. So now it's walking around neighbors in Boulder, but it's still a wonderful experience.
It's out in nature.
Yeah, so I'd say the other way of coping with this pandemic, you know, is being very thankful for the Buddhist teachings, you know, of seeing how some emotion arises, some feeling of claustrophobia, some feeling of irritation with my wife, my spouse, mm-hmm. some sense of despair of the things I read about in the newspaper. And mm-hmm. I, you know, the practice there, you know, is like with the emotional rescue practice, you know, and the other practices, you know, is to kind of catch that gap in thoughts before they become these really big, powerful emotions, you know, that are overwhelming. Yeah. So I'd say that's another way that I appreciate our Buddhist training mm-hmm. and really try to practice it. And I think it does help for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when you said emotional rescue, that's based on the teaching of Kunlap Rinpoche mm-hmm. about how to work with emotions.
Yeah, definitely. And I remember in that Nalanda Bodhi study curriculum, we had teachings from Kunlap Rinpoche that were in a Buddhist context, but very similar to what he was teaching in emotional mm-hmm. rescue. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is there any other things that you would like to say or talk about in our conversation here?
Well, you know, another passion I have in this pandemic has been to find some ways where within our Sangha, you know, we can find ways to connect with each other. You know, so you and I did that two book clubs. One was on the Heart Attack Sutra, one was on a beautiful book by the Karmapa on interconnectedness. Doing these, trying to set up these interviews, you know, mm-hmm. really have a way of connecting this way. Mm-hmm. You know, co-teaching a class with Steve, you know, and trying to find some ways to do some more of that. Mm-hmm. Trying to encourage people, you know, to think about ways to connect. So that's been another passion for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people said, you know, one of the things about the pandemic that's been kind of a blessing is we had these richness of teachings, online teachings. You don't have to be in Seattle to have a teaching. So I attended the weekend retreat of Nalanda Bodhi. Beautiful, beautiful. I couldn't believe how well that went. I don't really like doing Zoom things that much, you know, mm-hmm. but that was a wonderful weekend. And then signed up for the Natartha Summer Institute shortly after that. And that was really well done too. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
you've been busy. Really
good, yeah.
Seems to me you have been very active in terms of reaching out to Sangha, doing study, been a busy Sangha person. I appreciate your looking to create connections amongst the Sangha.
Most of the time it's a joy, you know, trying to help out in that way and trying to do some things. Yeah. And it's you know, we're fortunate that there are two Dukkhas. We have a wonderful Sangha. We really do. You know, just really kind people, you know, genuine people. You know, no real arrogance, no real drama, you know, just people wanting to practice the Dharma and, you know, be part of a community like this too. So we're very lucky that way.
I agree. I'm very thankful.
Yeah.
I'm very thankful to know you and to have done these various projects together with you. Mm-hmm. So thank you for your willingness to have this conversation. And we will see where these conversations go. So thank you.
Yeah, well, you're quite welcome. And I'll put a pitch in for these things too, because we sent the questions out ahead of time. And this last 3 or 4 days contemplating these questions has been very beneficial for me to go back and think about, how did I come to the Dharma? That's my North Star. Yeah.
Yeah.
So a side benefit of doing this work. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Oh, and I said work, but the operative word for us is fun.
Fun.
Yeah, being able to laugh. Exactly. Not taking ourselves too seriously, I hope.
Yep. Exactly. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Very much.
Okay, cool. Bye. See you around sometime, Douglas.
Bye, Doug.
More often than not. Okay, that's good. I like you a lot. You're a good deal. Okay, I'm going to stop the recording.